from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, how President Trump's budget proposal could affect California. An ominous Los Angeles Times headline predicts it would reignite our state's financial strains. Trump's proposal makes deep cuts to the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and eliminates entirely funding to the National Endowment for the Arts and, yes, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The White House says it's about shrinking government and protecting the nation's safety. We assess the needs and priorities of California against the Trump budget next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Here's how California's Director of Finance, Michael Cohen, described President Trump's $1.1 trillion budget proposal yesterday. Quote, "The president's budget proposes a complete withdrawal of the federal government's commitment to working with states to solve the critical issues of the country, from environmental protection and emergency preparedness to transportation and other infrastructure." Trump's budget proposes deep cuts to the EPA, HUD, and Health and Human Services. It eliminates the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting in order to put $54 billion more toward defense spending. All these moves have far-reaching effects on California, where federal dollars constitute about a third of the state's budget, including the scaling back of a number of programs that serve the poor. In this hour forum, we look at how Trump's initial budget proposal hits the state of California, and we're joined by H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director of External Affairs at the California Department of Finance. Good morning, H.D. Palmer.
Good morning, Mina.
Thanks for being here. And thanks also to Evan Halper. He's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times based in Washington, D.C. Good morning, Evan Halper.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for being here. And Evan Halper, I'd like to start with you. Just to be clear from the outset, Congress writes the budget, not the president. So put in context for us the role of this so-called skinny budget.
Well, it's basically the first marker that the president's putting down, and he's saying this is what I would like to do. It's not being received very well in Washington, as we've seen in Sacramento many times. When a governor comes out with a budget and what finally gets passed is very different than what's proposed, there's low expectation that the final budget that gets passed in Washington looks anything like this. But, you know, keep in mind that you do have a Republican House or Republican Senate, and there will be cuts. It just won't be of this magnitude, probably.
Right. That's the concern, that even though there is some pushback from Republican members of Congress, that the president is in sort of the best position to make his wishes come to pass with a Republican-controlled Congress. So then, Evan Halper, what jumps out to you in terms of this budget's potential effects? I know it will take weeks possibly to fully suss this out, but what initially strikes you?
Well, you have to keep in mind there's two things going on here that are sort of going on concurrently. We have this budget came out, but what affects California the most isn't in the budget, but it may happen more quickly, which is, of course, the repeal of Obamacare. We just found out that'll be voted on by the House on Thursday. You know, that has its own problems, and we'll see what happens with that. But, you know, when we talk about a third of the California budget coming from federal dollars, most of it is in the form of Medicaid,
right,
which drives California's Medi-Cal program. And with what they're talking about with the Obamacare repeal over a period of a few years, they're just talking about cutting that back dramatically. I think the figure I saw from the advocacy groups Health Access in California was something like a $66 billion dollars in Medicaid would be cut back by like 15, as much as $15 to $20 billion, and that's just a massive hit.
And then you also write about, I think your summary included in the piece you wrote for the Los Angeles Times, police forces would be cut, schools could face layoffs, and cleanup of contaminated lands would be put off. Some of the things that really also jumped out in your article were the cuts to, signature initiatives of our state for people who are very low income.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, when you look at what they're doing with all these budgets, the EPA gets hit the hardest, and, its budget would be reduced by about 31%. And a lot of that, it comes in the form of of these grant programs that the state relies on to do cleanup and remediation efforts and environmental enforcement. I mean, they're cutting, like, you know, they would cut the number of enforcement agents who are sort of out on, you know, the environmental beat dramatically, and the state doesn't have the resources to backfill that. You know, they're cutting the low-income heating assistance program. You know, it's like Meals on Wheels. It's, you know, it's all this stuff. And then you look at these, and then the budget, as you mentioned before, it's a skinny budget. So there's a lot of places where they just didn't provide a lot of detail, but the cuts are of such magnitude, like the education department, where they want to shift money toward charter schools, and you know, like as you mentioned, you know, other programs that could include food stamps. That you know, even if it doesn't say in the details right now how it would play out, it's hard to see how they can make the cuts of the magnitude they're talking about without going after some of these programs. And you know, also the most concerned right now are a lot of cities and counties, because they sort of have this, you know, three-legged stool approach to a lot of the programs they fund. And, you know, even community development block grants, which seems like a kind of obscure program and has this long name, but, you know, I was talking to Kern County supervisors. I mean, they are using these funds to actually, like, pave, you know, dirt roads that are falling apart, because it's, like, all they have to, it's the only discretionary money they have to do these things. And then we're even seeing things like, public transit would be cut, really dramatically. Projects that don't already have a funding agreement underway would just be canceled altogether. So, you know, in Sacramento and in LA, where they have these streetcar programs they're trying to get underway, those would just have to be scrapped. You know, already we knew about the electrification of the Caltrain.
Right. H.D. Palmer, as you're hearing Evan Halper describe the effects of this budget, do you agree with his predictions and characterization that this would require a significant scaling back of programs for the poor? It would, make a huge impact in terms of community development block grants on cities and counties that rely on them?
First, Evan's reporting on the federal budget, as usual, has been spot on. He's quite correct. In fact, one of the programs that Evan referred to are the ones that Director Cohen was talking about in his statement that you led off with. When he was referring to infrastructure cuts, he was talking about the elimination of the Community Development Block Grant program, which is about $3 billion nationwide. And transportation, Evan referred to, I believe, the cuts that are proposed for the Federal Transit Administration's Capital Investment Program, which has significant effects in the state. But Evan is also absolutely very correct in that when you look at what the state budget reflects in terms of federal funds next year, on top of the $179.5 billion in state funds, we also reflect expenditures of about $105 billion in total from the federal government. Of that amount, about $78 billion is associated with health and human service programs. And of that amount, as Evan referenced, about $67 billion is associated with the Medi-Cal program in California. And to a very great degree, as Evan notes, a lot of what's going to happen in that is not necessarily reflected in the budget document that the Office of Management and Budget put out yesterday, but is going to be affected in the Congress in terms of how they choose to modify the Affordable Care Act. And the initial measure was reported out of the House Budget Committee on a very narrow vote yesterday. And as Evan indicated, it'll be up for debate next week and could very well be altered significantly from the form in which we know it now.
And getting a little more specific in terms of programs, what could happen to in-home supportive services, for example, which provides care for the elderly and disabled?
We are continuing to look through the details of the federal budget. As Evan indicated, the first reporting of the first wave that comes out is broad-based in terms of the numbers and the programs. But when you really need to find out specifically how it's going to affect California, not only from a fiscal standpoint, but in terms of how it would affect recipients for in-home supportive services or Medi-Cal or the state's welfare to work program, a lot of that's going to take a few more days to kind of dig down into the more granular details of the budget that are just coming out. One example that I can point to affecting California, to be specific about it, is something called the State Criminal Alien Assistance Program, which is a longstanding federal program by which states such as California are reimbursed by the federal government for the costs that state and local governments incur for incarcerating inmates who are undocumented as determined by whether or not they have an immigration hold on them. The federal government proposes zeroing out that program of about $210 million for what they claim is a poorly targeted program that focuses on a handful of states that have these incarceration costs. Well, yes, California happens to be one of those states that has a disproportionate impact relative to the other 49 states. We've budgeted, based on past appropriation amounts, about $50 million for the state budget next year is associated with that. It's not a new proposal by the Trump administration to zero this out. Administrations of both parties, President Obama, President Bush, also proposed zeroing it out. And Congress, you know, which has the power of appropriation at the end of the day, said we don't agree with that and we're going to continue appropriating that. And I think one of the things you're going to see going forward on any number of these projects is that while the president has proposed eliminating any number of those or paring them back significantly, I think support or opposition to a number of these programs does not cleave neatly to partisan boundaries, as I've indicated. For example, the Community Development Block Grant affects a variety of different districts, a variety of representatives in the state of California. So this is the opening act, if you will, of a multi-act play on the federal budget that we're going to be seeing in the months going forward.
Well, one of the things both Michael Cohen and Evan Halper at the start of this conversation highlighted were the issues related to environmental protection. So let's take that up. We're joined now by Matt Rodriguez. He's California's Secretary for Environmental Protection. Good morning to you, Matt Rodriguez.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. As we've heard, the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, is slated to lose 31% of its budget or so. And I'm just curious how that translates to Cal EPA's budget. I know that Cal EPA relies on 10% of its budget coming from federal dollars, but that's not necessarily going to mean the elimination of all 10%, correct?
No, it won't mean the elimination of all 10%. We will be losing probably around 100 positions by our estimates, and there will be several tens of millions of dollars that will be cut from budgets. We're still looking for the details, of course, and we'll look forward to getting more information from the federal government in the future.
What are you doing right now in anticipation of cuts to Cal EPA?
We'll be looking at, you know, what programs will be being cut, whether there's some way to backfill those from state resources. And looking at, you know, what we can do to make sure that we can continue the various programs will be affected by the cuts.
My understanding is that you're concerned about climate programs, environmental justice programs, science funding, all of this being affected negatively. Also, Evan Halper brought up the issues about hazardous waste programs losing money. What does that mean? Does that mean fewer inspectors, less enforcement, as he mentioned?
You know, the effects in California will be at two levels. One, as we've talked about, it'll be affecting some of our programs, and it will make it more difficult for us to obtain information about air quality, for example, because there will be reductions in air monitoring. It will make it a little bit more difficult for us to obtain information about border and the environmental issues on our border with Mexico, because we received some funding from the federal government for that. It will probably slow down the cleanup of Superfund sites, that is, heavily contaminated sites, where we've worked cooperatively with the federal government to clean up those sites and make sure that they're safe for their surrounding communities. So there will be impacts on California and California programs. Just as importantly, however, what we're seeing is that our partner at US EPA is being hamstrung by these cuts as well. And we've worked very, very closely with US EPA on a whole variety of programs through the years. And that coordination could be working together on enforcement matters, working together on cleanup matters, additionally working with EPA on research and obtaining information about some of the environmental problems that we face. And that's one of the real problems, I think, that we're going to have to deal with, is losing that partnership with EPA, because clearly there's not an interest in the administration in obtaining information about environmental problems and trying to develop solutions to deal with them.
And the EPA, the Cal EPA's budget, as I understand, is $3.7 billion. Is that right?
Yes, that's right.
And the State Department of Natural Resources is $5.3 billion?
That sounds right to me.
So the effects to the Natural Resources Department, I don't know if you can speak to this, but one of the reasons I'm asking is because one of the concerns that's been raised are cuts to regional programs, like programs in San Francisco, to restore the Bay. Do you know anything about that?
Well, two things. Let me say that I think the press coverage on this, as one of the previous speakers remarked, has been pretty good and pretty accurately described some of the impacts we'll be looking at. My understanding is that there will be cuts on programs to protect San Francisco Bay. I know that there are proposals to cut funding for coastal planning efforts. We have received historically funding for our coastal program and the Bay Conservation and Development Commission, and I think we're going to have to look at the potential for cuts in those areas as well.
How concerned are you about the rhetoric that's coming out of the Trump administration with regard to funds for climate change? I believe Mulvaney referred to it as a waste of taxpayer dollars.
Well, obviously, we disagree with that. As I think the governor's made clear, we consider climate change in California to be one of the most serious problems, if not the most serious problem facing the international community. And turning our back on that issue and ignoring all the information that's out there is completely unwarranted. It's a problem that we need to deal with. California has stepped up. We have some of the most ambitious programs in the world. We're going to continue to work on those programs. But saying that climate and problems are not real is just, sticking your head in the ground. It's ignoring a significant problem that we really need to deal with.
How are you most directly connected to the federal government in terms of as a partner on climate change?
We worked collaboratively with the EPA on the Clean Power Plan. California supported the Clean Power Plan. Certainly, we had discussions with the federal government on how we were going to meet the targets that had been set by the Obama administration to reduce greenhouse gas emissions for the United States. California is going to be a big part of that national effort to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. We're still going to continue with that work, and we're still going to continue to work with other states, such as Washington and Oregon and some of the East Coast states who have reduced emissions from their power sector. So we're going to work on climate issues, we'll continue to do so, but we will miss our federal partners, and we'll continue to try and engage the federal government to get them to pay attention to what is a very real problem.
Yes, Cal, EPA, as I understand it, really relies on the Fed's research and science to base your own decisions for programs and implementation.
We do. We're fortunate in California to have some very good scientists working for us, so we are going to continue to do that research. But as I said, it's one of the things that is the most concern to us, that you're seeing great cuts in the Office of Research and Development at EPA, because, when I was in school, we learned that, decisions that are made are only as good as the information that goes into those decisions. And so that's why it's vitally important for us to continue to research and really understand what's going on in our world and take a look at, in particular, the effects of greenhouse gas emissions and the fact that the federal government is turning its back on that seems very, very short-sighted and clearly will lead to poor decision-making at the federal level.
Well, Matt Rodriguez, I appreciate you talking with us this morning. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Matt Rodriguez, head of the California Environmental Protection Agency. Evan Halper, while we're on the issue, the subject of science, the National Institutes of Health programs. My understanding is that this year they'll provide more than $210 million for researchers in the UC system, and that would fall by about 20% in this budget proposal?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know exactly how much a particular institution like UC would get hit. You know, as some of the points HD made before about we're in the early stages of understanding the details here, but more broadly, yeah, the way science and research is getting hit in this budget is really astonishing. I mean, yeah, these are research programs with really broad bipartisan support. I mean, even Newt Gingrich was a big booster of the National Institutes of Health and again, I don't know about the political viability of them, but what the Trump administration is signaling is that they just want to really, really gut those programs, which obviously would have rippling effects throughout the economy. I mean, not just at UC, but, you know, in private industry. I mean, a lot of, a lot of the science that ultimately gets marketed or becomes products or whatnot, I mean, it starts in a lab funded by the federal government.
And as far as schools go, you had written in your article, in fact, you quoted the former finance director, Mr. Genest, who said that this particular budget, should it come to pass, would mean teacher layoffs. How does he figure?
You know, he was expecting there to be cuts in special education, which turned out not to happen. If you look at the Department of Education budget, there are no cuts in special education. So what Mike was projecting would happen based on, you know, all the buzz we were hearing about what would be in the budget, that particular piece of it was not. That all said, if you look at the cut to the Department of Education, somewhere in the 10% range, and you look that they also want to shift a lot of money toward putting a new charter school initiative in place, you wind up with a cut that will trickle down to local schools that, you know, in some way they're going to have to figure out how to make up that money. And it's a cut that the state is not obligated necessarily to backfill. So, again, if this were to come to pass, whether it be teacher layoffs or not, it's hard to say, but, there would be pain that local schools would feel from this budget.
Could California point to any positive impacts of this budget? I mean, charter schools, as you mentioned, they could get a big boost.
Yeah, I mean, there are a number of slivers of the California economy that could really be helped by this budget. If you look at, like, obviously $54 billion in defense, there's still a lot of the defense industry still has operations in California, and that could boost that part of the economy. There is interest in kind of shoring up and giving more of a boost to nuclear energy and nuclear arms, and you know, a lot of research and development of that happens and could happen in California. So, there are places where, yeah, California could benefit.
Well, Evan Halper, I know we need to let you go at the break, so I want to thank you for talking with us.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
Evan Halper is a reporter for the Los Angeles Times based in Washington, D.C. We're also talking with H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director of External Affairs at the California Department of Finance, and we were joined earlier by Matt Rodriguez, California Secretary for Environmental Protection. More after the break on what Trump's budget proposal released yesterday could mean for California. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about President Trump's first federal budget proposal released this week and its potential effect on California. And I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation by giving us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, post them on our website, kqed.org/forum, on Facebook or on Twitter. We're at KQED Forum. We're talking with H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director of External Affairs at the California Department of Finance. Trump has proposed deep cuts to core federal agencies and the elimination of funding to the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Trump also wants to end funding to the Corporation for public broadcasting that supports public media stations across the country, including KQED. And joining us now is John Boland, President and CEO of KQED. Good morning, John Boland.
Good morning, Mina.
Thanks for coming in. I wanted to ask you, what would zeroing out of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting mean for KQED and other public media stations?
Well, it really varies from one part of the country to another, or depending on the size of the community. But to put it in perspective, the amount we're talking about in the federal budget is generally between $400 and $500 million. It varies from year to year for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And I saw that a reporter from the Washington Post yesterday figured out that that is 0.07% of the trillion-dollar-plus budget. And that comes out to $1.35 per citizen, which is, you know, a pretty good deal. When
per year,
yeah.
It's amazing.
You consider there are 1,500 public radio and TV stations serving every community in the country. So in terms of KQED, our share of that last year, for example, was $5.8 million. We're one of the larger public broadcasting operations in the country and receive one of the larger grants. But it's really a small portion of KQED's budget, and that's one of the keys to this. It's an amazing public-private partnership, because this $400 or $500 million leverages a great deal of community support, as we know from our corporate sponsors and from our members who call in during a pledge drive. So with KQED as an example, we received $5.8 million from the federal government. We leveraged that to raise another $65 million from the community to provide a public broadcasting service that has a budget of over $70 million. So it's strange to think that this would be something that would solve a budget problem, when in fact it's the kind of investment that leverages community support, and, you know, the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, so to speak.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting has been on the target list of administrations in the past. Do you see what's happening this time as different?
Yes, actually different and possibly, just possibly, if we're fortunate, different in a positive way. This is not a surprise, and it's not something that hasn't happened before. In fact, during the George W. Bush administration, every year for 8 years in a row, President Bush did exactly what President Trump just did. He sent a budget to Congress that had zero for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And every year for 8 years in a row, the Congress restored the funding. I would say at this point, we actually have more support in Congress among Republicans,
really,
than we did during the George W. Bush administration. And I think that's because of a lot of work on the part of public broadcasters to be in touch with their elected officials and to have people from the community in touch with their elected officials to really explain how important this service is. I think most people don't realize that public broadcasting is now the only universal broadcast service in the United States. It's the only network, if you will, that reaches over 99% of the American population. You may think that NBC or CBS or Fox does, but they don't. They only go where it's commercially viable to have a station. We go everywhere. And what's important about that is that public broadcasting partners with both FEMA and Homeland Security to provide an early alert system for the entire nation, and also to provide data casting to first responders. So there's much more to this than just the public radio and television that people turn on in their communities.
Well, even though you're optimistic, it sounds like, based on the types of reactions that you're getting from Republican members of Congress and this Republican-controlled Congress, it seems that the response by public media has been more organized. There's a campaign. There's a website that people can go to show their support for public media. So has this been building up?
This has been building up. And I would say that even though we think that this is a worthy service and a worthy use of government funds and are optimistic about, again, restoring funding, it will not be easy. It never is. And there's a lot of competing priorities in this budget, and every one of those budget cuts has a constituency. And so we know that Congress people or senators who may have a strong commitment to public broadcasting may be buffeted by other winds during this budget process. And so it's going to be very important that we do carry on a campaign to make sure that they remember how important this little tiny piece of the federal budget is. And yes, protectmypublicmedia.org, which is the website you referenced, is a national effort that joins together all public radio and TV stations and all citizens who support them, where you can sign up and you can find out what the latest is and you can find out how you can help, because it's really a long battle. This is just the first step, the budget going to the Congress in an outline form. It'll be many months from now that the actual decision will be made about the funding, and it's going to be at those key moments when there are votes in committees or in the Congress that we'll need all of our supporters to activate.
Well, one last thing. Sesame Street has been one of the most effective means of highlighting the value of public media to the general public and has been invoked in the past when CPB cuts have been raised. Is that undercut now by the fact that Sesame is at HBO? Sesame Street is at HBO. Can you still invoke it?
I think so, because actually the programming all still appears on PBS first. but I think what Sesame Street became was kind of a symbol, because of course there are many more children's educational programs that have come along since Sesame Street and in fact surpassed it in audience. I think the important point about the Sesame Street question is that these stations are so much more than what we think at first glance. For example, 69% of all the children in the United States between the ages of 2 and 8 watched those educational programs on PBS last year that helped them to get ready for school, and particularly in underserved communities. That's the other one other important point I want to make is that if this were to happen, which we hope it won't, and we will work very hard to prevent it, the KQEDs of the world will still be here, because if, you know, it's 8% of our budget, but if we need to, we can survive without 8% of our budget. In many rural communities and underserved communities around the country where there's not a lot of commercial broadcasting, this may be the only outlet for them. And those are the stations that depend on that CPB money much more than KQED. It may be 6 or 7 or 8% of our budget. It might be 50% of the budget of a public radio station in a rural area. That station will close.
Well, I just want to read this one comment from Stephen, who writes, should funding get cut, KQED and other public stations should go off the air from midnight to 6 a.m., broadcasting only a message that the station is off air due to Trump cuts.
Well, that's an interesting idea. I hope we don't come to that. I think there's a very good chance that that we'll secure the funding as long as we have the support of people who really care about the service.
John Boland, President and CEO of KQED, thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And David writes, we have a military that has fought 2 concurrent wars and enough nukes to end the human race. We don't need a larger military. This budget erases the safety net and funding for the most vulnerable among us. Jim writes, this budget is a perfect statement of class war. I believe the Republican goal is to replicate South America here in the U.S. The country will be run and controlled by several hundred families, and the rest of us will be powerless as their servants, serfs, or slaves. We're talking about Trump's proposal and how it could affect California with you, our listeners. If you want to add your comments as well, you can do that at forum@kqed.org. Post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. And you can call us, 866-733-6786. Let's hear now from John in Palo Alto. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning. I'd like to understand whether there's anything about Trump's pledge to improve the nation's infrastructure and to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure reflected in this budget proposal.
John, thanks for the question. H.D. Palmer, we were talking earlier about his attempts to basically significantly scale back funding to the Department of Transportation's capital improvement grants.
Well, again, there's some inherent contradictions that we're seeing in the budget. On the one hand, there's a statement that says we want to have an increased investment in infrastructure, but we see in some of the programs like community development block grants and transit and other areas that we're still working through that there will be an effect on infrastructure in the state. And again, as had been noted, the expenditures on the defense side plus the infrastructure are weighed against the significant cuts and eliminations that are proposed to what are called non-defense discretionary programs that aren't entitlements like Social Security or Medicare. So a lot of the details are still coming to light today as we look into the bigger – we talked about the skinny budget of 66 pages that the OMB put out yesterday. There are thousands of pages of budget documents we have to go through to understand what's being proposed, what the policy implications are, and what the trade-offs are on this.
And let's hear next from Anthony in Concord. Hi, Anthony.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I appreciate the conversation today. So Robert Gates said that the defense budget could sustain a cut of $100 billion, yet at the same time we're beefing it up with $54 billion from our discretionary budget, which has to be taken from other vital programs such as the arts, you know, your Meals on Wheels, all these different things. I mean, would any mother approve of a budget like that is the question I want to ask. I mean, seriously, we're coming to a time where we're complaining about how much we pay in taxes, and no one ever wants to talk about the fact that we spend over $600 billion a year on a program that really doesn't need that much money. And if we spent what we did, just a fraction of what we spend on defense every year, we could fix all of the world's issues. The UN says there's a program that if we spend $120 billion, we could solve world hunger. Like, hello? You know, let alone this whole problem. I don't know. I wish people would wake up and understand and do a little research, people. Like, go do the math and realize that this isn't going to work. That's all.
Well, Anthony, I think you're channeling what we're hearing from a lot of listeners right now in terms of their frustration. When you ask about what mother, H.D. Palmer, I imagine maybe the mother of a child who's in defense-related industries in California.
Well, as Evan indicated before the break, there is an increase, obviously, that's proposed in defense. The defense and aerospace industry used to be an absolute mainstay of the California's economy. And what we saw at the end of the 1980s when defense spending declined at the end of the Cold War was kind of what people referred to as the dark side of the peace dividend, when we saw the defense and aerospace industry basically collapse as we knew it in Southern California in the early 1990s. And that was one of the things that contributed to the recession in the early 1990s that took a number of years to grow out of. There is absolutely a defense and aerospace industry that still exists in California, primarily in the southern part of the state. But there's a lot of research that's being done in the Silicon Valley in Northern California that's likely to benefit as well.
Yes.
But as the caller suggests, there are going to be trade-offs into how much more money is going to be put into the defense area at the expense of other non-defense programs.
Again, we're talking with H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director of External Affairs at the California Department of Finance. In terms of interesting trade-offs and contradictions, Carol writes he's slashing thousands of jobs while maintaining that he's going to get jobs for everyone. Go figure. H.D. Palmer, can I ask you how this is playing out in terms of California's budget process, right? I mean, we just a very short time ago heard about, you know, the state facing a $1.6 billion shortfall. How is this playing into that conversation?
Well, we're in the early parts of that. We're evaluating it. As we indicated earlier, the largest effect on federal dollars in at least the short run is going to be what happens in the Health and Human Services area and in Medi-Cal, California's version of Medicaid, and that's moving on a somewhat separate track with the debate over the Affordable Care Act and what may or may not replace it. A couple of other areas. Evan mentioned a moment ago what's going on with research. I mentioned at the outset there's about $105 billion in funding from the federal government that we're reflecting in next year's budget. Of that amount, about $5.2 billion is represented for higher education, and of that amount, about $3.8 billion represents estimated expenditures for the University of California that are related primarily to federal research grants and contracts. So we're still, again, 24 hours after the ink has been drying on this federal budget, looking at how that might play out in terms of the federal policy. In terms of the state budget, you're quite correct. We've got to close a budget gap of about $1.6 billion. Through the end of February, we just put out our revenue bulletin yesterday. We're running about $250 million below projections. We're coming up on April, which is going to be the most critical month in terms of tax receipts. And we will update our economic and revenue forecast in May when we come out with what's called the May revision. And the other thing that we'll reflect to the extent that we know it at that point is to what extent any changes in federal policy, such as in the Affordable Care Act, may have an effect on state finances. So we're looking at the federal budget issue, which is not going to be resolved by then. We will look at the Affordable Care Act debate. We will look at state revenues. We'll look at the state economy. And we'll have an updated and better assessment in about 2 months in terms of where we stand on that.
Has this reinvigorated any conversations about declaring a fiscal emergency and being able to dip into the rainy day fund?
At this point, no. Again, remember that what the federal government proposed yesterday, as a number of folks have said, is a proposal, and it's just that. Congress has the power of appropriation, and there are going to be a number – there's never been a presidential budget that I've known in my 30-plus years of working in federal and state government that's been adopted sight unseen and said, no, don't change a thing, don't mess with a cross T or a dotted I. There are going to be some changes and significant ones at that. We just don't know what they're going to be yet. One of the things that Governor Brown will be doing as we continue to go through this budget is to identify in specifics how this budget is going to affect California for better or worse, to the extent that it affects it for the worst. He will be working in very closely with members of California congressional delegation from both parties to identify those areas and determine what work we can do in the legislative branch to be able to change that budget for the better as far as California is concerned.
Well, certainly congressional members of California's delegation have been very vocal. I mean, Dianne Feinstein called this the most draconian budget she's ever seen. Linda Sanchez suggested that this was a way that this is aimed at punishing California. Are you concerned at all about the tenor from the state legislature in terms of its communications with the White House as being an entity that will fight it tooth and nail, that will work against it?
Well, the governor will continue to be a forceful advocate for California's interests, and I fully expect the members of the congressional delegation will as well. And as I said earlier, I think in a number of these proposals, particularly on the non-defense discretionary side, there are going to be proposed reductions or eliminations that are being put forward by the president and the executive branch that are going to meet bipartisan opposition. And in those cases where it's in California's interest, the governor looks forward to working with members of both parties and the congressional delegation to change that blueprint.
And let's hear from more of our callers. And again, that number, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Steve in Sebastopol. Hi, Steve.
Hi. And this is especially for HD. I'm on a small school board in Sonoma County, and I'm wondering how you expect federal cuts to affect state funding that it is passed through from the feds to local districts.
Thanks.
And also what the impact of what you're talking about at the state level in terms of revenue.
Yeah. Thanks, Steve. Good question. Again, to go back to that $105 billion we've got budgeted next year, about $7.5 billion of that goes to K-12 programs. The biggest chunk of that is the National School Lunch Program, which is about $2.1 billion. Another $1.7 billion goes to what are called Title I grants. The school lunch program is an entitlement program, so I don't anticipate at this point that we would see any changes in that. But again, like so much other parts of this federal budget proposal, we're still sifting through the details. In terms of the state share of funding, we even in the process of closing a budget gap of $1.6 billion, as I had indicated, we're still looking at year-over-year increases of about $2.1 billion for K-12 schools and community colleges from a combination of state general fund and local property tax. So what's going to happen in Washington is definitely on our radar. There's about $7.5 billion in funding for K-12 above and beyond the $52.3 billion just in general fund alone, excluding property tax. That's in the budget for the coming year, and we will continue that work on the federal aspect at the same time that we'll be looking to see what changes are going to be reflected in the revised budget that comes out in May.
Steve, thanks for the question. Rex asks, how much are we paying for the wall? I saw that Trump has requested, $2.6 billion for building the wall. It's one of the biggest projects proposed in his budget. Any sense of what California's role in that would be?
Well, there's not a checkoff on your federal tax return saying, I want 10 cents to go to the wall, or I don't want 10 cents to go there. I want it to go to defense. Those are decisions that are made by the federal government, and the best way for individuals to express that concern is their locally elected federal representatives, their United States senators and their members of Congress, to indicate to them, whether it's in letters to them in Washington, D.C., or whether they're here in town halls, whether they agree with President Trump's proposals, whether they disagree with President Trump's proposals, to make those views known. And I think it's fairly clear that, you know, on both the support and the opposition, that certainly people have been making their members of Congress known, very aware of what their views are on both sides.
And also trying – members of Congress trying to – and state lawmakers trying to exploit the extent to which California contributes to the federal budget. Another listener writes, remember both President George Herbert Walker and George W. Bush's popularity spiked following Desert Storm and the Afghanistan invasion. With Tillerson's comments in Tokyo and Donald Trump's budget increase for defense, I suspect Trump's motive is to start a war with North Korea. Cole writes, anyone who thinks public broadcasting isn't a cause worthy of government support should watch Mr. Rogers' address to the Senate in 1969 or just spend a day listening to KQED. My day wouldn't be the same without it. Well, thanks, Cole, for that. Fair to say, HD.
Mina, could I jump in on that for
please.
A second? And I was thinking about John's comments earlier, a little bit out of my lane, but in my former life, or lives, I should say, I was a spokesman for United States Senator Jim McClure from Idaho, as well as Governor Dern Kempthorne of Idaho. And so I did a lot of work with Idaho Public Radio. We are fortunate in this state to have large, very healthy stations such as KQED in the Bay Area and KXJZ here in Sacramento and KPCC in Los Angeles. But John's point was exactly right. The dollars that go to those states like Idaho and other states in the Intermountain West in terms of being able to provide both national programming from NPR as well as local programming and reporting are much more critical, I think it's fair to say, in those rural areas than they're certainly critical to stations here in California, but much more so in some of the smaller, more rural states.
I think there was a quote or a rebuttal to Mulvaney's point that coal miners don't want to spend money on public media. And I think James Fallows was saying something similar to your point, that in fact it's in rural areas that public media
is most popular. Humbly suggest that listeners of West Virginia Public Radio might have a different take on that.
Well, Kate writes from the impact of the NEA is essential and wide-reaching. She's from the San Francisco Arts Commission. She says each $1 in NEA grant funds leverages another $9 from other public and private sources. The grants and programs that the NEA administers are powerful examples of how the arts are a vital part of our everyday lives. This power can be seen in communities across the nation, and California is no exception. The NEA indemnity program is critical to the success of our local museums. Without this support, museums could not afford the insurance premiums necessary to host traveling exhibitions such as Matisse Diebenkorn at the SF MoMA. And yes, this was the point that John Boland was making earlier, that even if the dollar amount doesn't necessarily impress somebody, the fact that it can be leveraged to the degree that it can should. Let's go now to Bill in La Honda. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I love the head of KQED talking. But I think the Corporation for Public Broadcasting needs to go to the rural communities that are going to be hurt worst. You know, our urban area in San Francisco will survive just fine because I donate, a lot of people do, and we'll get by. But these rural communities, I think we need to advertise there and tell them, look what you're going to lose. And I don't know that they know that. You know, a huge percentage of them are Trump supporters. And that's the one free station that a lot of them get.
Bill, I thank you for that point. And I think you're right. I think the public media stations across the country are really seeing this as a national issue and really seeing it as an opportunity to raise awareness of the value of public media in places where people might not associate their programming specifically with their public media station and how much they do, in fact, rely on it. So thanks for that, and thanks for supporting us. Your comment is noted. And let's hear next from Jenny in Berkeley. Hi, Jenny.
Yeah, hi. It sounds like you haven't talked about the issue of reforming Prop 13, which would result in a $9 billion into the California budget. And the way it would work would be that commercial real estate Their taxes have been held flat since Prop 13 was passed in 1978. And meanwhile, property taxes on homeowners like myself and have been going up through the roof. It's resulted in catastrophic cuts to the budget, particularly the school's budget over the years. And Nancy Skinner and another representative whose name slips my mind right now have put a bill on, have sponsored a bill that would lift the cap on commercial real estate property taxes in the state of California. This would not affect residential property taxes, and it would not affect small business property taxes,
Jenny,
only commercial real estate.
Well, Jenny, thank you. And Prop 13, of course, is an ongoing issue, and it does come up with new vigor, especially when California is facing budget pressures. David writes, it sounds like a good idea to put pressure on these agencies to cut wasteful spending. I'm seeing clear negotiation tactics, putting something over the top out there and then negotiating, give in on things that are easily compromised over, such as public broadcasting funding. H.D. Palmer, hoping this is just a negotiation tactic.
As I said, it's the first act of a multi-act play. We will see how it plays out.
H.D. Palmer, Deputy Director of External Affairs at the California Department of Finance. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Mina.
And thanks to you, our listeners, for your questions and comments about President Trump's first federal budget proposal and its effect on California. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Judy Campbell, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineer today is Katie McMurrin. Our engagement producer is Jeremy Siegel today, with online support from Amanda Font. Our interns, Devin Holt and Stephanie Roberts. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.